Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Ambush at Central Park, When the IRA Came to New York, by Mark Bulick, narrated by Joel Richards. Introduction. Bloody Anniversaries.
There is a significance in dates, the president declared.
Warren G. Harding was addressing a top hat crowd, the American Secretary of State, the Venezuelan Foreign Minister, assorted South American ambassadors, the Governor of New York, the Mayor of New York City, and sundry diplomats and dignitaries. Behind them stood a crowd of up to 20,000, gathered at the highest points in Central Park to hear the newly inaugurated president. He'd taken office just the month before. The dignitaries had removed their top hats when the president arrived. But April 19, 1921, was raw and wet, and Harding had tried to drop a hint, saying they might all get a cold. When that didn't work, they all still just sat there, hats in their laps. Harding looked around, laughed, and put on his. They all followed suit, and he launched into his speech.
This is the anniversary of the Battle of Lexington, when the colonies of North America made their first sacrifice in blood for independence and new standards of freedom, Harding intoned. On this same day, a generation later, Venezuela's struggle for freedom had its immortal beginning.
Then he gave a ringing affirmation of the Monroe Doctrine, saying the United States would fight, if necessary, to keep the Americas from the colonial enterprises of old world powers. But before all of Harding's saber-rattling and speechifying about blood sacrifice, two young sisters briefly stole the show. Their hands trembling, their hair ribboned in the red, blue, and yellow of the Venezuelan flag, 9-year-old Mariquita and her 5-year-old sister Patricia gripped cords attached to some bunting. The bunting covered a statue so large that it frightened them as they shivered in the cold drizzle. Patricia, a perfectionist even at age 5, seemed nervous to the point of tears. Standing by for moral support were their mother and the sculptor who had created the giant statue, Sally James Farnham. In a large veiled black hat, Mrs. Farnham seemed to the girls as formidable as her creation. They couldn't imagine how she had managed to get the huge figure of the man up on that immense horse. Then came the command, and the girls pulled the cords attached to the giant American and Venezuelan flag bunting that covered the statue. Everything went fine for Mariquita, but Patricia's cord caught on the prancing steed. A sailor from the honor guard came to her rescue, grasping her hand and pulling. Down came the bunting. The crowd roared. There in full caped glory rode Simon Bolivar, the great hero of South American independence, astride an immense charger. On the way back to their seats, the girls stopped to present gifts to President Harding and the Venezuelan Foreign Minister, Dr. E. Gil Borges, 2 stick pins, made from the gold buttons of Bolivar's uniform. They'd been passed down to the girl's mother, Catalina Violante Páez, the granddaughter of the first president of Venezuela, General José Antonio Páez, who had fought beside Bolivar to free Venezuela from the Spanish crown. Then Harding stepped forward to speak about inter-American relations and the significance of dates and blood sacrifice and the cause of independence from colonial powers. When all was said and done, and the president and Mrs. Harding had made their way to his open touring car, 9-year-old Mariquita wriggled her way through the crowd, clawed her way onto the running board, and gave the president a personal farewell.
"I just came to say goodbye, Mr. Harding," she said.
The president tipped his top hat, the first lady offered a sweet smile, and off they went as a Marine lifted Mariquita to the ground. The crowd was dissipating, the photographers taking a few last shots, and the reporters tucking away their notebooks. The event would lead the next day's front pages, with the city newspapers hammering home Harding's tough stand against European imperialism.
"U.S. will uphold Monroe Doctrine even if it means war," blared the New York Herald.
War headlines could always be counted on to convince the undecided to cough up a couple of pennies for the paper,
and the anti-colonial angle had a special resonance in this particular town at this particular time. Ireland's war for independence from Britain was reaching a fever pitch in the first half of 1921, and New York City had more Irish than Dublin. At least 630,000 Gotham residents were first or second-generation Irish Americans, many with parents, siblings, aunts, uncles, and cousins back in the old country, giving them an immediate stake in the fighting there. Hundreds of thousands more city residents came from older Irish stock, but if their family links to the old sod were more distant, in many cases the emotional ties were strong nonetheless. The Irish dominated the Catholic Church, the police department, and democratic politics in the city. Their clout on the docks was such that in 1920, longshoremen staged a political strike in support of Irish independence by refusing to handle British ships. That same year, New Yorkers raised $1 million to aid the fight for Irish independence, thanks to the barnstorming of the leading spokesman for the anti-colonial cause, Eamon de Valera, himself a son of New York City. His tour of the United States had left Irish-American supporters of independence divided, but it created invaluable publicity for the struggle at home. He certainly impressed Mariquita and Patricia's father, the Irish writer and nationalist Seamus McManus, who described De Valera as cool, resolved, gentle, masterly, humble, firm. McManus's anti-colonial credentials were almost as strong, and certainly more recent, than those of General Pius. Nearly 20 years before, McManus had been part of a small group that, in his own words, formed the nucleus of Sinn Féin, the Irish movement battling for independence, even as Harding's words about Lexington hung in the air near 83rd and Central Park West. He recalled years later that he had to quit a teaching position in County Donegal after he was wrongly suspected of being that most hated figure in Ireland, an informer. "Things became so hot for me that I had to resign my position," he wrote. Eventually, McManus landed on New York's Upper West Side, where he kept involved with the fight for Irish independence. And that fight came to the sidewalks of the Upper West Side, practically in the shadow of the Bolivar statue, a year to the week after the McManus girls unveiled the monument. On April 13, 1922, a team of gunmen from the Irish Republican Army ambushed a former comrade who had betrayed the independence movement and fled to New York. Just before the shooting, the gunmen shoot away some children loitering near the Bolivar statue. They didn't want any kids getting caught in a crossfire. The location of the ambush may or may not have been a coincidence, but the timing was certainly no accident. The informer was shot a year after he got 6 IRA comrades killed by Crown forces. That massacre in Ballycannon, Cork, came on the Wednesday of Holy Week, known in Ireland as Spy Wednesday, for the day Judas betrayed Jesus for 30 pieces of silver. The Cork informer was a paid spy, too, and he was gunned down in New York on April 13, 1922, Holy Thursday. "Almost a year exactly since the Ballycannon murders," the triggerman said. As Harding put it, there is a significance in dates. What follows is the story of 4 comrades from the Irish War for Independence, and their paths to and from a bullet-riddled reunion in Manhattan. It is the story of the war's main battleground, Cork, and New York's role in the struggle. It is a tale of gunmen and gunrunners, informers and spies, courage and betrayal, assassinations and abductions. It is the story of the only authorized attack by the Irish Republican Army on American soil. Chapter 1. The Ambush. When the relentless avengers of the Irish Republican Army finally caught up with Cruxy O'Connor in Manhattan that fine spring evening, they sent 6 bullets his way, 1 for each man the informer had sent to an early grave the year before. 4 of the gunshots found their target, and as a cop reached the crumpled victim on the steps of a finishing school at 84th and Central Park West,
O'Connor was clutching a revolver with a spent shell in each chamber. After one of his attackers dropped the gun, the fallen O'Connor apparently had grabbed it, intending to defend himself. But the weapon was useless by then. His assailant had emptied the revolver at him. O'Connor hadn't had much luck in the weapons department lately. There was that machine gun they had given him for the ambush the year before. When he told them that it jammed just as the shooting started, the boys started looking at him funny. Not long after that, he'd made the mistake of taking a pistol to Sunday Mass. The coppers threw a cordon around the church, and oh dear God, what a massacre that led to. 6 men dead, including Willie Deasy, his next-door neighbor, just 20 years old. Pa Murray and the boys blamed him. They had stalked O'Connor through 3 countries. He'd barely escaped with his life when they tried to poison him, and he'd had to quit his job as a bookkeeper at the B. Altman department store a month earlier, after the gunman had started haunting his workplace. For weeks now, his only escape from the cramped apartment on the Upper West Side of Manhattan had been a walk and a smoke. He varied his route, just to be on the safe side. But there were some evenings, like this one, when he couldn't stay cooped up in the flat on Columbus Avenue with his parents, his brother, his sister-in-law, and their toddler. The warm spring evening beckoned, its soft westerly breezes stirring the curtains of Manhattan. He needed a cigarette. He needed a stroll. It was a few minutes to 8 o'clock on the evening of April 13, 1922. O'Connor came bounding down the stairs of his apartment building, but even as he headed out the door, he knew, on some level, that this was crazy. 3 of County Cork's deadliest gunmen, Murray, Danny Healy, and Martin Donovan, were out there somewhere in the New York night, just itching to take a shot. There'd be hell to pay for what he'd done, and the Devil's Own bill collectors wanted their due. O'Connor headed east up 83rd Street, toward Central Park, where the sheer black rock of Bolivar Hill loomed like a dungeon wall. When he reached Central Park West, he turned north on the west side of the street. The temperature was in the low 60s, so there were plenty of other pedestrians out taking the night air. O'Connor smoked nervously, his eyes on their faces. When he reached 84th Street, he glanced to the left, and sweet Jesus, there was Pa Murray himself, with another guy headed straight for him. O'Connor dashed across the street to the wall that lined Central Park, glancing back at Murray and puffing furiously on a cigarette. He headed north, then suddenly reversed himself. And that's when Danny Healy came out from behind a tree, right smack in front of him. In a gray coat and gray fedora, Healy looked like some kind of natty avenging angel. It all happened so fast. Healy, pointing a revolver at his chest, saying something like, "I've got you now," then pulling the trigger. Danny Healy and Martin Donovan had been near the corner of 83rd and Columbus, staking out the flat, when O'Connor walked out the door and headed toward the park. Pa Murray and Mullins, a guy from Derry who signed on for the hunt, were a little further up Columbus, near 84th Street. Healy asked Donovan to tell Murray and Mullins to head up 84th Street toward the park, where they might be able to head off O'Connor, while Healy came up from behind him. Once he caught sight of Murray, O'Connor had been too preoccupied to notice Healy until he stepped out from behind the tree. The gunman thought his first bullet caught O'Connor in the chest, but he dashed across Central Park West into the 84th Street intersection. Healy chased him, blazing away, hitting O'Connor twice. To Healy's astonishment, O'Connor kept going, ducking around a trolley. Healy followed, firing a shot that thudded into a building. 4 bullets gone, only 2 left, and his prey was still scrambling. O'Connor kept changing direction, like a panicked hare flushed by a pack of hounds. He tried to go north on the west side of Central Park West, but almost ran into Donovan, who pointed a revolver and squeezed the trigger. Nothing. A misfire. But the bullets were finally having an effect on O'Connor's adrenaline-infused body. wounded, winded, and bleeding, he slumped to the sidewalk.
"I caught up with him and fired twice more at him, hitting him," Healy recalled.
As Healy blasted away, the getaway car came roaring up to the intersection, a kid from the Bronx at the wheel. Healy knew he was supposed to get in, but he just stood there, frozen, surrounded by a large group of gaping pedestrians. He couldn't imagine he was going to get away with it. This wasn't home, where people knew to look away when Murray and the boys cut someone down in the street. This was the very heart of Manhattan, and a horde of people were staring straight at him. One thought kept going through his head. No chance of escape. Then Donovan's commanding voice rang out.
"Run for it, Danny! Run!"
Christ, but Healy took him literally. Donovan saw Healy snap out of it, but instead of getting in the car, Healy walked casually for a bit, then broke into a run west on 84th Street. And Donovan saw the crowd of stunned pedestrians form into a posse that quickly gave chase. Dozens of them. They figured it was an underworld hit, and they weren't about to let a bunch of gangsters get away with murder in the middle of Manhattan. Donovan climbed into the car. It looked natural enough. He was wearing a chauffeur's coat he'd gotten from the Bronx Kid's family. And then they were all giving chase, the car and the crowd, until the car got ahead of the posse and kept pace with Healy for a bit, while they tried to talk him into getting in so they could all get the hell out of there. The trouble they went through to get that getaway car.
Over 1,000 cars in the St. Patrick's Day parade, and they couldn't use one of them, Donovan complained.
Finally, Johnny Culhane from the Bronx came through. He had an auto rental and taxi business, but he wanted no part of driving a getaway car for a killing. Culhane was already facing a boatload of legal trouble involving several hundred Ireland-bound Tommy guns the feds had confiscated from a rust bucket docked in Hoboken. As Culhane begged off, his 17-year-old son James jumped in, exasperated.
"I'll drive the damn car," he said.
Which was how they ended up with a kid from the Bronx as wheelman. And now, after all that, Healy wouldn't get in the car, even with half of Manhattan on his tail. Clearly, someone would have to put a stop to this posse business, Donovan realized. At 34, he was the grown-up in the group, older than the others by a decade. He'd have to do it, or it wouldn't get done. It would have helped if he'd still had the revolver, but Donovan had tossed it after it misfired. Why keep a useless, incriminating weapon at a crime scene? So now he'd have to pull off a bluff, one man against close to 50. But Donovan had gotten Danny Healy into this mess by recruiting him for the O'Connor job. Healy hadn't hesitated then. Donovan didn't now. He got out of the car and confronted the crowd, just 15 feet away. If even one of them dared to make a quick lunge, he'd be hopelessly overpowered in seconds. So Donovan slid a hand into his coat pocket, as if to pull a gun.
"What do you want?"
"Trouble," he asked the man at the front.
"No?"
"Well, where are you going?"
"I'm going right back to where I came from."
The man turned on his heels and did just that, followed by most of the crowd. Then another quick conversation with Danny about getting in the car, but it didn't do any good. The normally reliable Healy was rattled, out of his element, not thinking straight. Donovan had shouted, "Run," so run he would. Healy and O'Connor, the shooter and the shot, had one thing in common that fine spring evening. They were bound and determined to stretch their legs, even if it killed them. As the getaway car pulled away, Healy continued on foot, passing the building where O'Connor lived, 483 Columbus Avenue. But he wasn't alone. A single pursuer remained on his tail. Healy zigzagged his way through the street grid of the Upper West Side, toward the subway entrance at 79th and Broadway, unable to shake the man tracking him. He caught a bit of luck inside the station. A train was just about to leave as he entered. He jumped in as the doors closed, leaving his pursuer behind. Healy got off at 42nd Street, emerging into the bright lights and swirling human tides of Times Square. Crowded at night, he noted. He headed south to the rendezvous point, Jimmy McGee's apartment on the east side near 38th Street. Jimmy was a big shot in the Marine Engineers Union and served as a dockside fixer for the boys. On this job, he had fixed them up with revolvers, including the one that misfired for Martin Donovan. After a long time, Paul Murray showed up at McGee's place, but Donovan was still out on the street, and they were starting to worry. Had he gone back to the Bronx with their teenage driver? Had someone from the crowd that Martin turned back decided to come after him? Finally, Donovan arrived. No, he told them, nobody had interfered with him after that show of bravado on 84th Street. That was the thing about Martin. The man could radiate cool menace with a look and a word. He'd make you think he was reaching for a gun, even if all he had in his pocket was lint. Back at the scene of the shooting, onlookers lifted the gravely wounded victim to the steps of Semple School for Girls, a finishing school. O'Connor, 26, had been shot in the back, the side, the stomach, and the jaw. A patrolman walking his beat on Central Park West, just south of 81st Street, heard the shots and came running. As Officer Jansen hurried to O'Connor, he saw the bleeding man clutching a revolver. When the officer examined it, he found the 6 spent shells. He asked O'Connor who he was and where he lived, and the victim told him. But when Jansen asked, "Whose gun is this?" O'Connor didn't answer. He had lapsed into unconsciousness. At that point, a woman who had witnessed the whole thing spoke up. "That man didn't do any shooting," she said of O'Connor. The victim was rushed off to the Reconstruction Hospital at 100th and Central Park West, where doctors didn't like his odds. Then the detectives took over. In the immediate aftermath, they considered various theories about the shooting, that it had something to do with bootlegging or a quarrel about a girl. The truth, they soon discovered, was far more complicated. One of O'Connor's relatives showed up at the scene and told the police that he had fled war-ravaged County Cork just the previous year, and that he had served in the Irish Republican Army, which was locked in a brutal war for independence from Britain, and that he had been forced to leave Ireland because of threats of death that had been conveyed to him through mysterious channels. All of which added up to one astonishing conclusion. The Irish Republican Army had just conducted an attack on American soil. The newspapers splashed the thing the next day. "Link shooting here with Irish warfare," the New York Times declared on the front page. "Shooting victim in Irish treason plot, say police," the Evening World blared. The Times story made clear that O'Connor knew the man who shot him and knew he was being stalked. The World added that a fully loaded .38 Colt revolver had been recovered near 3 West 84th Street. Witnesses had spotted a man running from the scene tossing something there. If the gun was fully loaded, it wasn't Healy's. He had emptied his. Paul Murray held on to his piece, so it had to be Donovan's. That was why none of the witnesses saw him draw a gun when he confronted the posse. The newspapers offered eyewitness accounts from some young boys. The stories were contradictory in their details, but consistent in their general thrust. The gunman had warned the kids to clear out just before the shooting. According to the Times, the boys were hanging out by the 83rd Street entrance to the park, just opposite the Bolivar statue, when a car pulled up. A man in a cap jumped out, told them he was a detective, and asked what they were doing. "We're just getting the air," one of the boys replied. "Well, beat it on out of this part of the park and get the air somewhere else," he replied. In the World's version, the boys were near the 85th Street entrance when they saw O'Connor and another man talking in vehement tones as they headed out of the park. When the man with O'Connor spotted the boys, he demanded to know what they were doing. "Just playing," they said, whereupon he announced, "I'm a detective. You'd better go play somewhere else. Get out of the park." According to the World, the two men exited the park, talking loudly, and turned south on Central Park West. The victim broke into a run, and the other man pursued, blazing away. The two stories don't fully jibe. In one, the detective is a guy in a cap who jumps out of a car. In the other, he's the gunman, who we know is wearing a fedora, and instead of jumping out of a car, he's strolling and talking with his intended target. Healy never said anything about warning away children. All we can be reasonably sure about is that one of the hit team chased away the boys, and Healy said something to O'Connor before shooting him. It may have been the notion that he had a walk in the park and a lengthy conversation with O'Connor that caused Healy to scoff at some of the reporting. Needless to remark, the newspapers the next day carried reports of the shooting, some of which were highly colored, he said. The papers played up the gray fedora so much that it was decided that Healy should ditch it. The next day, Healy and Donovan deemed it advisable to quit the city and state of New York, leaving their digs on Lexington Avenue and beating it across the Hudson to stay with Donovan's sister in Jersey City. The newspapers, meanwhile, had firmed up the Irish angle, reporting that investigators learned the victim had been condemned to death for passing information to the British that led to the killing of several IRA men. An April 15th headline in the Times reported that O'Connor had been shot as a traitor to Sinn Féin Army. On a visit to the hospital, O'Connor's mother let slip something that lent some credibility to the talk about him being an informer. Before joining the IRA, she said, he'd been a member of the Royal Irish Constabulary. There was one odd thing about the policeman-slash-informer story, though. O'Connor, fading in and out of consciousness, absolutely refused to give the detectives any information about who had shot him and why. He told them how it happened, but whenever he was asked to name his attackers, he would resolutely shake his head. The informer wouldn't inform. Chapter 2. Feuds and Fights. For 100 years, they've told stories in County Cork about Cruxy O'Connor, or Connors the Spy, about a man torn by divided loyalties in a nation riven by revolution, in a world ripped apart by war, about a normal lad from a normal Irish family from a normal Irish neighborhood who went off to join the British Army in World War I and rose to Sergeant Major, and how he became a hero in the horror of the trenches in France, earning his nickname when he was decorated for valor with the Croix de Guerre, about how he returned home to Cork just as Ireland's struggle for independence from Britain was erupting and agreed to become a paid spy for the Crown, about how he joined the Irish Republican Army and sabotaged the rebels during a crucial battle with British forces, claiming that his machine gun jammed, about how he got a beating afterward, about how he betrayed 6 rebels from his Cork neighborhood, leading the police to their safe house and watching as they were captured, murdered, and mutilated, and how a vengeful IRA came within minutes of poisoning him in a British barracks in Cork, where he was being held for his protection with a strychnine-laced meal delivered by a woman masquerading as his mother, about how he fled for his life, first to London and then to New York, pursued the whole way by the IRA, about how the Avengers spotted him at the St. Patrick's Day parade and killed him in a spectacular Manhattan ambush with a gun borrowed from an Irish-American cop, and how the gunman got away with it because an Irish-American prosecutor sympathetic to the IRA quashed the case. It's an incredible story, and the most incredible part is how much of it is actually true. What we do know is this. Cruxy's real name was Patrick, Paddy to his friends, and he came from a quiet, respectable family. At least, that's what people usually said whenever the O'Connors landed in court after one of their many brawls, feuds, or run-ins with neighbors. The O'Connors may or may not have been quiet and respectable, but they were certainly never ones to leave a blow unanswered, either with a back of the hand or a court summons. The family, often called Connors or Connors,
lived in a simple labor.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?